Well, not so. Today we'll move on to the third of the four measurables. But I thought just a very brief kind of backing up an overview of the four, not in terms of definitions and all of that, but in one particular way might be helpful. And that is to view these four as, I'll give my own evaluation, an extraordinarily wise system of emotional regulation. That sounds like a rather utilitarian way to view loving kindness and compassion, which are some of the most noble virtues that a human being can experience. And they are that. They are absolutely noble virtues, and they're not a means to something else. I mean, they are absolutely of value in and of themselves. At the same time, there is so much need for emotional regulation, the ability to balance our emotions, that this has enormous relevance to that. So what I'd like to do is just highlight four points, one for each of them, to show how they can really provide very practical methods for cultivating emotional balance. And so we'll look at the first one, loving kindness. And you'll recall that loving kindness is the antidote, the remedy among the four. Loving kindness is the remedy when we fall into an emotional state where we're just kind of really, just feeling very hedonic. I mean, the mind is really looking outwards to something out there that's going to make me happy. Whatever it is, I don't need to give examples. But when we find we're really going samsaric, you know, just looking outwards and Dharma's getting boring or whatever, then what is the balance? And so when empathetic joy goes astray, it falls into just the craving for hedonic pleasure, right? So among the four, this is the majesty of these four. You don't have to go outside of the family. Within the family, there are remedies for each of these four immeasurables that go astray. So, quiz time. When you just fall into kind of just hedonic craving and grasping and so forth, among the four, I think I've already told you. What's the remedy? Loving kindness, yeah. And it's so wise and it's so gentle. I would almost say it's motherly. It has such a friendly quality to it. You want, you know, whatever it is. And again, who needs to give examples, but something in the world that will give me hedonic pleasure. And it's almost like a mother saying, you really want happiness, but you're looking in the wrong way, in the wrong place. Why didn't you look where it really comes from? And find the inner causes of happiness. They're right at your fingertips. They're closer than your fingertips. They're inside, you know, and really reflect upon what can really bring you happiness. And reflect upon that in a very loving way. And that brings you to loving kindness for yourself, and then you start extending it for others. You start finding happiness through the very cultivation of loving kindness. And then the attraction of the hedonic pleasures diminishes because there's so much happiness already. So there's one. Loving kindness is a remedy. If I give it an order, then I'm giving away all the answers. Let's take another one. Let's imagine that you... you really just fall into viewing people as attractive and unattractive, appealing and unappealing. Oh, that's too easy. Okay. Figure that one. Okay. What do you do if you just find yourself getting despondent? Despondent, kind of just out of hope, lacking inspiration, maybe kind of a dull depression, not really depressed, just kind of like apathetic, maybe a little bit depressed. Uninspired. Yeah. It really works. And it's not doing something silly, like we say in English, putting on rose-tinted glasses to try to put a happy face on everything. After all, this is the tradition that says samsara is an ocean of suffering. You know, so it's not exactly a rose-tinted view of reality. But empathetic joy, when there's depression, and when it's just flat out apathy, indifference, just what's called in Buddhism stupid indifference, then it's compassion to arouse you out of that. Well, today, as you know, then we're going to empathetic joy and to inspire us. I mean, that's the word zeng dopa, to inspire. Just trying to think what the Tibetan is. Inspire is a word that's very juicy in English, and I'm sure it's translatable into other European languages. But where do we draw the inspiration from? Because the practice isn't going to be fun every day. And for those of you concerned with progress in shamatha is not to be evaluated week by week. So I'm very happy to see you each week. But to come in and say, well, this week, not much progress. That's kind of like baking a cake and say, over the last 3 minutes, I don't see much happening. Well, you don't bake a cake in 3 minutes, right? I mean, I've never baked a cake in my life, so I don't really know what I'm talking about. But I would assume that's too short a time scale. In the last minute, in the last 60 seconds, I've been watching the cake. Nothing's happening. I think maybe it's not baking. It says 400, but I don't know, you know. So 1 week is too short a timeline. 1 month. 1 month to see, is the mind becoming calmer, a bit more stability? Are there more sessions when there's continuity of attention? Is the continuity getting a bit better? 1 month, that's not a bad timeline. So for inspiration, for bringing a kind of a lightness to the practice, an enthusiasm to the practice, all of the above, a kind of hopefulness. There is a time for hope, of course. We wouldn't travel around the world to come here if we didn't have some hope that participating in such a retreat could be beneficial. Otherwise, why bother? Stay home, watch television, you know? Watch a nice movie on Phuket. And so to arouse these qualities so that enthusiasm really arises. Of course, practicing loving kindness and envisioning the flourishing one's own practice, oneself flourishing in the practice, that helps. But in a way that's to be seen. Will we indeed flourish or not? Well, that's in the future. But what I'd like to suggest for the next session is that we go into the mudita, empathetic joy, keep it individual, and trace back in our own lives to those who, over the course of our own lives, have inspired us, nurtured us, helped us, cared for us, and above, especially inspired us in Dharma. This itself can bring such gladness and lightness to the heart, and this is very much in line with formal bodhicitta meditation. It's called tinte, senjingi, katin temba, or recollecting the kindness of sentient beings. It's a beautiful practice. And when it's done properly, I think I know some people, when somebody does something very nice for them, they just immediately think, okay, I got to do something nice back. They just gave me a bottle of wine. Oh, okay, I got to give them, okay, flowers, you do it. It was a $10 bottle of wine, okay, $10 bouquet, that should do it. Finished. You know, like receiving a kindness from somebody else puts us into debt. And then we have to repay the debt. I know some people like that. They really feel very uneasy about receiving other people's kindness, and as soon as they do, they think, okay, you took me out to dinner, okay, now I'll take you out to dinner. Comparable place, different restaurant, same price bracket. Maybe I'll beat you by $5 and you can be indebted to me. You know? And so that's a kind of, I think, a sad kind of approach to gratitude, taking it more like debts. Whereas we know in the bodhicitta meditation, this whole sequence of meditations, when we're reflecting upon the kindness of sentient beings, katintemba, then the next step in it is tinenzoa, and that's the arousing the inspiration, the yearning, the aspiration to repay the kindness of others. But it's not like, I'll take you all out to dinner and then we're even, right? Everybody go home, okay, we're even. I don't owe you, you don't owe. It's not that at all. It's like the infinite kindness of sentient beings, right? In other words, the payment will never be paid until all sentient beings are free of samsara. So it's a very long-term loan, right? But I know from that kind of practice that when it goes well, there's a joyousness in it. It's attending to, as Shantideva says, it must be in maybe the introspection chapter. It says, when you're just walking along, like the walking along the street, and somebody comes into your field of vision, just reflect upon them. Oh, this is a sentient being who's showed me kindness in the past. And having that sense of connection. Oh, this person, maybe this person grew the lettuce for our salad today. Maybe this person, you know, raised the soy for the tofu. Whatever it means. I mean, I'm not very grateful on that point, actually, but, you know, that's just me. I can't digest tofu. But that's the side point. And so I let other people be grateful for the tofu. All right, but the point here is that reflecting upon the kindness of others and then anticipating, might I repay the kindness of others? It's a joyful, both phases are joyful. And there's no sense of, okay, now I've reflected on everybody's kindness, I've got it, I've nailed it, I know what my debts are. No, it's just infinite. And then to think of repaying the kindness, well, that's infinite too, but it's joyous. And then here's where the real bite is. Why do this? How can we repay the kindness of others? how can we write a big enough check? You know, what can we do? And then we're thinking, in order to fully repay the kindness of others, most effectively, really help them, not only in terms of alleviating temporary suffering and problems here and problems there, but really helping them in the most innermost way, I must really be able to help them be free of their mental afflictions. Then they'll really be happy. That's what I really need to do, get to the root of the matter. Help each sentient being be free of all mental afflictions, discover their inner resources for well-being, for wisdom, compassion. How can I do that? Oh, I have to be free myself of mental afflictions, and I have to discover these inner resources myself, and if I want to fully repay, then I just guess I better become a Buddha. And then that acts as a catalyst for bodhicitta. Okay, enough. So in that mood, though, not of thinking how much debts we have to pay, okay, as we reflect back upon the kindness of others, but in the spirit of lightness, of inspiration, of joyfulness, giving rise to enthusiasm for practice, let's have one session now in mudita, empathetic joy. Hopefully the sight of your meditation cushion is still a welcome sight. That when you approach it in your room or here, the sense of it is here as a place I can find rest. I can set my body, speech, and mind at ease. I can relax deeply, find an inner calm, an inner silence, and out of that, an increasing sense of clarity, of brightness, luminosity. Settle your body in its natural state. Settle your respiration in its natural rhythm. And for a little while, set your mind at ease, simply at rest, releasing thoughts and relaxing your mind with every out-breath. Gently letting your awareness come to rest in stillness in the present moment. With its own innate clarity. as you continue in the practice in this and in all other sessions, periodically check up on the face, especially on the eyes. See that the eyes are soft and all the muscles around the eyes relaxed, soft. There should be no contraction here. Loose, open, spacious. And likewise with the breath, see that it is in no way constrained or forced by what you are doing mentally. Many people have reported that when they have felt they were facing imminent death, as in an automobile accident, that in an instant their life passes before their mind's eye. I would invite you now to scroll through your life, the story of your life, twice, letting your life pass before your eyes. In the first run-through, from infancy on, recollect, if you will, and let your mind dwell upon those people who have cared for you in terms of your hedonic well-being, which is of such enormous value, without which the practice of Dharma is impossible. Those who have nurtured you as an infant, provided you with food, shelter, clothing, medication, love and affection. And run on through. I will speak briefly now and then go through the practice at your leisure. But in terms of allowing you to be where you are now, in terms of your hedonic well-being, education, medical care, support and advice, all that we need to flourish in the world, to live healthy and hedonically happy lives. Scan through your life, and as you reflect upon those who've shown you kindness, care, nurturing, offered you their best in a myriad of ways, pause time and again. Take delight in the kindness of others. First of all, simply taking delight that such kindness is shown in the world. And secondly, as you recognize this kindness was directed to you, then of course, allow the sense of gratitude to flow from the heart, as if you could meet each one and express your heartfelt gratitude. Let's meditate now in our own way, from childhood on to the present. you may well find there are more people to recall than you have time for right now. You can always return to the practice as you come to the present, and you may reflect briefly on the enormous kindness shown by the staff here. So attentive, so utterly focused on being helpful. Now let's begin a second time from childhood on. And for the cultivation of genuine happiness. For those who have inspired you to seek for more than simple hedonic pleasure. Who've inspired you to lead more virtuous lives, better lives. To aspire for higher ideals, who have offered you spiritual guidance and counsel, those who, simply by being present, perhaps engaging with you personally, have inspired you by their own qualities and the way they engage with the world around them, giving you hope, inspired you on your spiritual path. Reflect upon the noble qualities of these individuals, the goodness they bring to the world in general. And reflect upon the kindness they've shown you, and gladly arouse a sense of gratitude. as we bring this session to a close, arouse, if you will, just briefly. The aspiration, may I repay the kindness of others. May I help them find the happiness that they seek and the freedom from suffering that is every person's heart's desire. May I truly repay the kindness of others. Let's bring the session to a close. Well, Naso, I had another good talk with Klaus Hebben last night, and I'm happy to report that he's planning to return here to Phuket around June 5th, he said, give or take a day. So if all goes well, and that hinges, of course, a lot on the operation that will be on May 12th, if all goes well, I think we'll have a chance to see him here. I'd like him to introduce you all to him, as I'm sure he'd be very happy to see you as well. So that, I think, is some good news. I wanted to ask him, I did ask him, whether his ideas or plans had crystallized at all about creating the observatory, where people can go in for 1, 2, 3, 5, 10, 15 years at minimal cost, because very few of us entering in long retreat are coming in rich. You know, a few people, not many. And so I asked him about that, and I won't share all the details now because some of the details are yet to be worked out, but he did express a very strong commitment to creating such a facility. It'll be next door. And so the people in long-term retreat will eat in our cafeteria, so they'll just have a short walk. And so we're envisioning now, I'll be working with Nick and undoubtedly other people, just to see what is the wisest way to proceed ahead. But we're anticipating that there may very well be people who would like to, having had the basic training, just go off and achieve shamatha and take out 1, 2 years, whatever it takes, and just achieve it, and then have that as your base. And frankly, once again, once you've achieved shamatha, of course, if you wish to, then there's a really good reason to stay in retreat and just continue meditating 12, 14, 16 hours a day, and, you know, just not do anything else. Go for bodhicitta and just go for it. Go for vipassana, go for it. But recognize also that once you've achieved shamatha, you're carrying your meditation, you're carrying your milarepa's cave in your own heart. That is, you really can go where you want to go. Don't drop acid. No, don't drop acid. Oh, you don't know what? Drop acid means LSD. Take no LSD. I'm just kind of thinking, how could you really screw up your shamatha practice? That's one way of doing it. So, no LSD, no drugs, just say no. But apart from doing something really crazy, like taking drugs and screwing up your brain, you've got shamatha. And I asked His Holiness about this a year ago. If you've achieved shamatha, what are the chances of losing it in this lifetime? He said, oh, very slim, very small. You should be able to keep it your whole life. That's now your endowment. And so you carry your cave with you. And so then you can go off and you can be in service in the world, but whenever you come back to your cushion, boom, shamatha. So, in other words, if you go into the observatory for a long-term retreat, it does not necessarily mean a life sentence. maybe 2 years with good behavior, and we'll let you out on parole. So he is very committed to creating such a facility, trying to keep it very, very modest. And then we can reflect, how has Dharma really flourished in the past? And there have been places it has extraordinarily flourished. It's transformed society. Many people have achieved tremendous realization. And then by so doing, then that just really, the ripple effect is tremendous. And Tibet is a good example. Obviously, there are many. This is just one that I know better than others. And what good example of this is the king, Yishu Marbe, who invited Jo Atisha to Tibet. Yishu, Chanjubu, Yishu, Seti Sure, Yishu, Chanjubu, do you remember? Who is the son, Chanjubu or Yishu? Yishu is the son, and Chanjubu is the father who perished. So Chanjubu was the father, I believe, yeah. So there was a, what do you call him, a king, but simply of a principality, a region of Tibet, not all of Tibet, named Chanjubu. And so being a king, he had some resources. And Dharma was hit or miss. There were a lot of problems in Dharma in Tibet at that time for very, very good reasons and historical reasons. I'm going to keep this short. But the point was, this king had resources. And as it turned out, he actually offered his own life as ransom to invite Atisha to Tibet. Because he was captured by a neighboring king, and it was like a chess. It was like they were playing chess. I captured your king, so now if you want your king back, you have to give me the king's weight in gold, and then we'll ransom him back. It was almost looked like a game, kind of a weird game. And so he was captured, and they weren't torturing him. They just kept him as a ransom. And his countrymen then raised his weight in gold, and they were ready to pay it. They wanted the king back. And then King Chanjuyu said, no, don't pay it off. I'll stay in jail. You offer that money to Atisha. Because Atisha didn't really want to come to Tibet. And was hoping, this shows not that they bribe him. Atisha also was not crazy about gold. But it would show the tremendous dedication that this was a really passionate yearning. Please come to Tibet and spread the light of Dharma here. And that's what happened. He died in prison. Atisha did come to Tibet. His son, Yeshu, then hosted him there. But the point here, and I won't make this a long story, the point was there was somebody to catalyze it who did have financial resources. It was a king. And a person's weight, 150 pounds, 180 pounds in gold, that's significant. But then it doesn't always go on that way. It's not just rich people and kings who pay for the Dharma to flourish all over a whole country. It gets catalyzed that way, and it has time and again throughout history. Kublai Khan, another example, tremendous wealth, probably the wealthiest man in the world at that time. Again, inviting great pundits to Mongolia and catalyzing there, starting from the top down. But it wasn't just kings paying for the monks and the nuns and the flourishing of Dharma after that. The kings catalyze it. And then when the population sees, oh, this is really helpful, then they're inspired. And then you have people offering $5 here and $10 here. And then you have a grassroots movement of supporting people who are fully devoting themselves to practice as monks and nuns, yogis and so forth, building temples and on and that. So one example in Tibet was one valley, Amdong Naba, where I first visited in 1992. So Mugi's from there, Zhuaya. No, Mugi, I'm conflating you with two people. Mugi, of course, is from Mongolia. I just suddenly fused you with somebody I know from there. But it's a region of eastern Tibet. And Dharma was absolutely obliterated. There was not two stones standing on top of each other because of the Cultural Revolution. Absolutely wiped out. No monks, no nuns, no Dharma, no books, nada for this whole valley. And then in 1980, then suddenly it was okay to recite Om Mani Padme Hum again. And then what happened in this one valley? I know it well because another close friend of mine, Jigme, looks a little bit like you, but of course he's from Amdo, eastern Tibet. But he's from that monastery there. This was in 1980. They suddenly had now freedom to practice Dharma. Before then, forget it. You'd go to prison for practicing Dharma. From 1980, I first visited that valley in 1992, just 12 years later. There was Gomang Monastery with 500 monks, beautiful new monastery. There was Segomba, 800 monks, brand new, all adobe, New Mexico style, but eastern Tibet. And then there's Amjot Senyikgun, 500 monks. There was a Sakya monastery, 500 monks. There was Kitigumba, 2,000 monks. This is all in one valley in 12 years. And so you say, oh, what great king paid for all of that? Well, the great kings were in Beijing. They were not paying for this. It was grassroots. It was people offering up to 50% of their income to restore Dharma. Up to 50%. Monks, monasteries all over the place. So I looked at that. I was just blown away. This is when people really get it. They see the value of Dharma. So all of this is a little bit of a preamble to say, we don't have kings nowadays. I mean, there is a king of Thailand, a very noble man by all accounts. But for our little settlement here, I think it's obvious who our king is. It's a benefactor. It's Klaus. He's the one that's made this all possible. But for Dharma to flourish here over the long term, the king is still there. And maybe I stop using that. I think he would not care for that term. But he's certainly the benefactor, for sure. But we can't always look for one man. Okay, just dig deeper into your pockets. Dig deeper into your pockets, you know, for the next 10 years, 20, 50, 100 years. Deeper into your pockets. You're the man. You're the man. It starts there, but then it becomes broader. So as we anticipate people who may be so inspired, have the discipline and so forth, to go and achieve shamatha as a means then to really cultivate the mind in the most meaningful ways, bodhicitta, vipassana, and so forth. Then Klaus and I, as we spoke last night, we said, well, perhaps some people coming to shorter retreats, not everybody either has the will or the opportunity for the time being to go into long-term retreat. But maybe among those who need to go back to their socially engaged way of life, to children, family, work, and so forth, maybe some might like to sponsor a yogi for a year at maybe $10 a day. That's what we're hoping for now, $10 a day, support a yogi. So I'm not asking for, and I will not be asking for a show of hands, but something to consider, that we still have this, he's willing to build a whole facility. Can people who believe this is of value think maybe I could support half a yogi, or I could support a yogi for 2 months or 1 year or what have you? That would be a coming together, and that's the template where Dharma has really flourished. In Mongolia, started top down, but then the Mongolian people rose up. They've been supporting Dharma for hundreds of years there, and in Tibet, and in Thailand, and so many other places. So that's that. But food for thought, I was very encouraged. I mean, I was enormously inspired. I was almost shaken last night at just this ongoing, extraordinary generosity that Klaus displays. And he would be a little bit embarrassed, I think, if he knew that I was speaking of him in this way. So I think maybe I can give some, these are all really practice related, so I'm very happy with this, because we want to start there, we can always go to theory. But here, let's see if we can finish off fairly briskly this second, maybe even a third question of Malcolm from yesterday, and some very good questions from today as well. So from Malcolm, when you say keep the object of shamatha in mind between sessions, I wonder if simply practicing the four foundations of mindfulness, or I think it's actually better, the four applications of mindfulness, is that enough? Does it suffice? It's a different practice. It goes without saying, the Satipatthana, the four applications of mindfulness, are absolutely superb, noble, august, majestic practices. But they're insight practices, and shamatha is the basis for that. So what I would suggest is, rather than start getting into the investigative mode, which is what Vipassana is really about, it's really probing into the nature of reality, I'm glad you started there. So really laying that foundation of shamatha, which we so easily skip over, dismiss, or marginalize, not we, but often happens. And so there was a little bit of advice from this morning that I didn't pass on, that I think now is very timely, and it's very short. It was from Gyatso Rinpoche, when he was giving commentary on Padmasambhava's statement at the end of the practice we did this morning. Okay, we're doing this in four phases. We're following exactly, really closely, what Padmasambhava stated. And he said this practice of contracting, releasing, coming into the nature of awareness, releasing, he said this is very good, very, very effective method for overcoming laxity and lethargy. So some people are experiencing laxity and lethargy. You might try this one. Even if you don't want to have, for the time being, awareness of awareness as your primary practice, if at times the mind just gets a bit vague, a bit lax, dull, you might try this, you know, like a laser into awareness and then release. Laser into awareness and release like that. And, you know, arouse, refresh. Okay? So there is that. But then he says, Padmasambhava says, and then sustain mindfulness at all times in between sessions. So there it is. Well, that's a good maxim, but how do you do it? And Gyatso Rinpoche gave some very practical advice in this regard. It's in his commentary. This is particularly related to this practice of shamatha without a sign, where you'll recall the first phase is let your visual gaze and your mental awareness come into space and attend to space, not just spacing, not just going vacant, as we do in settling the mind, and directing elsewhere. No, in this preliminary phase of awareness, we're attending to space, and then concentrating, and then releasing, concentrating, and releasing. I mean, it's a kind of intensification of space and a release of space. Intensification of space and release of space. Now, what to do in between sessions? You can, especially in such a serene and unthreatening environment as this, where there's so little that we need to do, maintain an awareness of space in between sessions. So as you're walking, of course, you have your eyes open, you're not going to bump into anything, but as you have your eyes open, be in touch with the space in front of you. Attend to the space in front of you. Have that quality of non-grasping and sustain the flow of mindfulness that way. Do whatever needs to be done when you're getting your food from the cafeteria, attend to the food, but as much as possible, sustain that awareness of space. That's one thing, one possibility. Another possibility I've never mentioned, not in this retreat, it's called the Vajra recitation, or the Dorje Depa, Vajra recitation. And this you can do, and this would be a very good complement, whether you're doing awareness of awareness or you're doing mindfulness of breathing, those two especially. And it's called the Vajra recitation, and it can be done in elaborate ways, but here's a simple way. It keeps you engaged, and it helps to gradually let die down this obsessive flow of internal chatter, which is such a drag. And what it is during, the Vajra recitation is during inhalation, mentally recite Om. You come to the end of inhalation, and very briefly you recite Ah. Exhalation, Hum. In between sessions, we're not suggesting this would be a single-pointed practice, but just keeping pace with the breath. And by having Om Ah Hum, Om Ah Hum, you don't have to count, you don't have to remember where am I, how far am I in the count. Om Ah Hum, just three. Om Ah Hum, pretty easy. It just gets the mind to quiet down. Okay? So Om Ah Hum, you might try it, see how that goes. So those are two suggestions. If you're settling the mind in its natural state, then the obvious thing is keep on watching the mind. That's the general counsel there. So, or are you asking us to split our attention for example, when eating, eat and be aware of the breath, or when walking, walk plus be aware of the sensations? Yes, that's exactly right. But bear in mind, this is not introducing some kind of an alien multitasking endeavor. Because if you're walking, you're multitasking anyway, right? I mean, you're aware of the visual field, but you're aware of your feet, and you're aware of why you're walking in a certain direction. You don't say, where am I, you know? Hopefully. And so there's some multitasking just by going, you know, eating, by taking your dishes over to where we leave them for somebody else to wash and so forth. So it's not making life more complex, but in fact, it's making life simpler. Do what needs to be done in the world when walking, but it's simply, certainly, if you can walk and chew gum at the same time, you can walk and do Om Ah Hum at the same time. Right? Okay. So there's two out of three. And this morning in the guided meditation, I thought you asked or invited us to look for the gaps between the arising phenomena, kind of a temporal space. Yeah, a temporal lapse. Seeing or looking for its shape, color, characteristic, etc. So I see, I think I didn't express too clearly, but this gets cleared up quickly. Later, you invited us to examine the spatial qualities of space. This I found much easier, because after all, what would it even mean to speak of the color or the shape of a period of time? That's probably just a categorical error. Time doesn't have shape. We already know that. Whereas space might have shape. When you're attending to a space in between thoughts, maybe it's black. Maybe it's lavender. Maybe it's flat, maybe it's three-dimensional. So those are not silly questions. That's not a categorical error. So this I found much easier than the temporal space or gaps, because I found that when there were gaps in phenomena, I could be aware of awareness. If we were to look for temporal gaps, really trying to look at time itself, could you clarify this a bit more? Is there such a thing as temporal gaps in awareness? Hopefully not. That's called blacking out. Yeah, that's called blacking out. And so hopefully that's not happening. I think I probably could have used clearer words, clearer articulation there. We really, when we're looking at, what are we looking at and then attending, is that just a nothing or is it a something? It is a space. It's a space that may manifest most clearly in those intervals between thoughts, because when thoughts arise, they catch our attention, right? But then there's a lapse during that period that there's a lapse, then what's left? The space of the mind. So that was always the target, okay? We can speak of it without trying to draw a deep parallel, because I don't think there is one, but we can speak of these as space-time intervals, because they are an interval that's bounded by events. Whenever I think of physics, and I look over it at Enrique or at Emiliana. Two people have studied physics here. But a space-time interval, without going into general relativity, but it is time, it is an interval. But what you're really attending to is space. So it is a space-time interval, but the qualities you're looking at are space. Okay? So we're not trying to do a categorical error there. And so here is a question. I think I've pretty well done it. Would you describe in more detail the methods of practice between sessions? Well, I've covered those with the Vajra recitation, attending to space, attending to what's arising in the space of the mind. But also mention this, as much as we can now, in this wonderfully simple environment, we have so little to do, to then season the day as frequently as possible, even if it's 10 seconds, 15 seconds, season the day. Look for opportunities. Keep your antenna up, for opportunities to season the day with the four immeasurables. Season the day with the four immeasurables. Just attending to, making real, the people around us, our fellow meditators here, of course, the staff, the guards, the cooks, people are serving us, attending us. There they are waiting behind the counter, just waiting to help us. I'm just waiting like a bird perched on a wire. Just waiting to do something good for us, Somebody even brought me the notes. Kun Palm even brought me the notes as, I never expect that. I'm going to walk over and get the notes off the board. There she was 20 minutes before. Here are your notes. Thank you. I don't really deserve this, But thank you anyway. It was awfully nice of you. And so, mudita. Such graciousness. I don't know if you had contact with Kun Palm before, but she is so incredibly gracious, my goodness. But then having said that, who isn't here? In my experience, who isn't gracious and helpful and so humble? If anything goes wrong, then they're apologizing. Please don't apologize. Please, please don't apologize. So there we go. So season the day, times for loving kindness, times for compassion, plenty of times for mudita, empathetic joy. And of course, times to just engage with every sentient being as a sentient being, which means equanimity. And not just looking attractive, unattractive, and all that kind of nonsense. So, then, here's a big question. I'd like it to be a really short answer, and I'm going to do my very best, like 3 minutes. Would you give briefly list the 10 non-virtues? I imagine they would be good reference when attending to the four immeasurables with more specificity. Relationship of the four immeasurables, the 10 non-virtues. So briefly, not killing, doing our very best not to kill. I read just a couple of days ago, even there was a case of an arhat, a blind arhat, who was already an arhat, but when in his hut he crushed insects. He couldn't see them, and he killed the insects. And some other monk saw all the dead bugs on the floor, and they went and complained to the Buddha, "This monk's killing insects." And then the Buddha said, "He's blind." The guy a break. Jeez. See, we're not the only nasty people. There was nastiness back there, pettiness, judgmentalness. My goodness, give the guy a break. And he said, and then Buddha added, by the way, he's an arhat, so there's no way he would have killed these creatures on purpose. And since he's an arhat, there's no fault. So deliberately killing, that we avoid. Deliberately taking that which is not given, clearly, that doesn't need any commentary. Sexual misconduct, if we can pretty much be free of sexual conduct altogether, then in this context, that makes things simpler. Just do other things for 8 weeks, makes things life a lot simpler. Lying, deliberately misleading others, misguiding others, either through exaggeration or denying that which is true or just obviously saying that which is not. Abuse is harsh speech, and it's speech even, and there's a trick here. Some people engage in abusive speech and then think it's perfectly justified because they say, I was just being honest, or everything I said was true. So, you know, what's your problem? Everything I said was true. Abusive speech, harsh speech may be true. But if it's spoken with anger, with contempt, with disgust, disdain, if it's meant to harm, to put somebody down, to put them in their place, to show your own superiority over them, it doesn't matter whether it's true or false, it's still abuse. It's a nasty, nasty non-virtue. Slander is where we use words that, again, that are abusive, that are putting down someone, particularly, though, to create divisiveness, to disillusion one group towards the other group, one person to another person, to create disharmony, distrust, and maybe try to break up others so they like us more. Nasty, really kind of nasty business. That's slander. Idle gossip is any speech that is aroused by mental afflictions. All the rest, any speech that's aroused by mental afflictions, by greed, by craving for hedonic pleasure and so forth, all falls into the category of idle gossip. So I think it was Geshe Ngam Taike. By the way, when I first learned Dharma, this is the first Dharma I ever learned when I was in Germany. The first Dharma I ever learned from a person was the 10 non-virtues. And that's pretty much all he taught me for the whole year, 10 non-virtues. And the rest of it was, he was my language teacher, Dzongse Rinpoche, wonderful, wonderful teacher and lama. But in this regard, it might just be a helpful reminder that here, I think you will find this is not a rule, but it is certainly heartfelt advice with the simple motivation of wanting to help you in your practice. The more you really do rest in the default mode of silence, it's going to unclutter your mind. The more we start slipping into little conversations here, little conversations there, a little bit more internet there, a bit more internet there, a bit more conversation here, and then you sit down and you say, oh gosh, my mind is so blah, 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 blah. Well, that's because your mouth was so blah, 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 blah. And the internet was so blah, 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 blah. That it carries over. The ripple effect is carried right on through. And so you might just want to take stock. We're now almost as if today's Wednesday. Ho, we are. Finished 3 weeks, eh? 3 weeks, finished. Never see those 3 weeks. Bye-bye 3 weeks. Never happen those again. Spent, no refund. So as you anticipate the next 5 weeks, how to derive, it's a simple question. It's not the Wallace rule, it's not rules, it's not laws. It's over the next 5 weeks, how can you derive for your benefit the greatest possible benefit from this time here? And you might, some of you, not everybody, you might want to review the magnitude of talk. If it's really helpful, it's meaningful, and you find afterwards your practice is refreshed, it's inspired, it's better informed, excellent. If it was chit-chat, you might want to cool it. Malice or ill will is simply the wish that others may be harmed or not find happiness. Really sad. Avarice, the cravings for others' belongings, not wanting them to have it, wishing we had others. So it's a form of craving and attachment. And then false view. This is not, I think it's easily misconstrued or viewed from a cynical perspective as, oh, this is where the doctrine comes in. This is where you have to have a whole bunch of beliefs. It really doesn't have that ambience at all. It is if we believe something that is not true to be true, that's probably going to have some bad effects on our lives. If we just have beliefs about reality that are just false, then the repercussion may filter over. And if there are beliefs about reality that are core, that is, one may be mistaken, as many Tibetans were, for example, believing that the earth was equidistant between the earth and the moon and the earth and the sun. I think most Tibetans, for most of Tibetan history, believe they were the same distance. So what? You know, they weren't trying to travel there, so they didn't try to head off to the sun and run out of gas, because they only had enough gas to get to the moon. You know, so it had no repercussions there at all. So that was a mistake. I mean, I just don't think there's any way you can construe the moon and the sun being the same distance from the earth. I think that was simply a flat-out error, not true in any world that I know of. But being wrong on that point is kind of like, it never mattered. But mistaking other issues, like what is the true source of happiness, that could be disastrous. So that's where false views come in. So there we go. There was an interesting one here that I got earlier, so I'll address it earlier. this one. This is the question about, yeah, this is kind of a large one, but why not? Let's do a large one right now. It's not a big theoretical one. It's very much on practice. And this is the question is about practices that I suggest as this person understands it, attain shamatha, vipassana. May I say the person? It's a nice question. Yeah, it's from Stacy. It's a bigger picture. It's not a theoretical question. Now tell us, you know, something. Tell us the big view. It's a very practical question, but with a big view. And that is, what's the nature of this path that I'm suggesting? Now, first of all, and it's enormously important, I'm not suggesting the Alan Wallace approach to Buddhism. Who cares? I don't care. If there's some Alan Wallace dude from California came up with some new path for Buddhism, I wouldn't care myself. I mean, why should I? Right? And so when I'm speaking of a path here, I'm drawing on sources and I can tell you exactly what they are. There's one text that is studied, revered, debated upon, memorized verbatim by all schools in Tibetan Buddhism, and without difference, Munogen, Sakya, Gelu, Kagyu, Nyingma, they all study it. For those who really learn Dharma well, all of them study it. It was a classic in India. It goes way back to the 5th century. It's, you know, like the collected works of Shakespeare. I mean, just nobody doubts, pooh, this is really important. And what this one text does, it's one of the 5 works of Maitreya, received by a Sangha. Tremendous commentaries from India, Tibet, and Mongolia. A tremendous impact. What this one text, and it's maybe, I don't know, really short. I memorize it. You probably didn't. Lonsen Chiawarua, we all memorized it. Anybody who, you know, went through the monastic training. It's something, depending on how big the font is, about maybe 50 pages or so, 40 pages. Memorize it verbatim. In the monastery I was, we memorized it verbatim before we even began studying it. And that's also standard. And then every day all the monks would get together and we'd chant about 1/3 of it, just to keep it fresh. Chant it all together, and then go on and debate for 5 hours. And the next day we chant the next 1/3 of it all together, and so forth. So what I'm getting at is this is one of the great, great classics of Indian Mahayana Indian Buddhism. And what it lays out is the 5 paths and the 10 bhumis. That's what it's really about, laying a systematic presentation of the whole path from the beginning to the end, very detailed description of Buddhahood, the 10 bodhisattva bhumis, the grounds, and details, really tremendous detail of just laying out the whole map from beginning to end. And the basic structure is 5 paths, path of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, and then path of no more training. It starts with the path of accumulation. And the path of accumulation starts with and I'll just deal with Mahayana for the time being. The path of the Mahayana path of accumulation begins. When does the stopwatch start? You've entered the path. Click, 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 click. It ends when uncontrived, spontaneous, effortless bodhicitta arises. So before then, you may meditate. You're cultivating bodhicitta, reflecting upon, developing the 4 immeasurables and so forth. But when it gets to the point that like the dam breaks, and now bodhicitta is just flowing from your heart, your mind has become bodhicitta, and now your activities flow out of bodhicitta, and you don't need to develop it to make it happen, it arises spontaneously. That's called jumamayimbe, chanchukisem, uncontrived bodhicitta. You are now a bodhisattva. You're now a bodhisattva, right? And this is absolutely classic Indian Mahayana Buddhist teachings, embraced by all schools, absolutely no sectarianism here at all. How do you develop? How can you actually realize such bodhicitta? Well, you meditate on bodhicitta a lot. And if you follow the great teacher Atisha, he had already noticed in the 11th century that some Tibetans wanted to develop bodhicitta but would not spend much time doing the 4 immeasurables. And he had one of his ironic comments. He said, only you Tibetans know how to develop bodhicitta without the 4 immeasurables. You know, he was being sarcastic or maybe ironic. But what he's saying is there's no way you're going to develop bodhicitta without having the 4 roots of the 4 immeasurables, and not just as a liturgy, to brrr, you know, or some kind of a mantra you recite 100,000 times or what have you, actually cultivating them. And so bodhicitta arises from cultivating the 4 immeasurables, cultivating bodhicitta explicitly through the practice of Donglen and so forth. But again, I cannot say there's total consensus here, but many of the great scholars of Tibet, drawing on Indian roots, have stated and defended their statement that in order for that degree of bodhicitta to arise, shamatha is necessary. Shamatha is necessary. You need a wonderfully sane mind to develop a wonderfully sublime mind. Right? Those who disagree, it's a scholarly debate. Maybe they mean, oh, only you only need to achieve stage 7 or stage 6. Nobody thought. Nobody. I would just say there's nobody. None of the great sages in Tibet thought, oh yeah, just bring your stage 1 dysfunctional, lax, and excited mind, and that'll be good enough to develop bodhicitta. How could they say that? That's nuts. So it's either develop shamatha completely or get really close. Well, why not? Let's just say, let's go with those who say completely. So this is where this comes from. Just to make it really clear, this is not Alan Wallace's trip. I have nothing to add. But when I first learned this, and I think I mentioned this earlier, after Geshe Taiki taught us the Lamrim and the Chunju Bodhicattvatara, then he taught us the, it blew my mind. I thought, wow, there's a majestic path. Laying out these 5 paths and just the crescendo of it, the nobility, the majesty of it, just blew my mind. And then later, for my own, I'm going on too long, sorry. Maybe I'll cut it short. But when I was in the monastery, I'm living like a Tibetan monk. We're doing everything in Tibetan. We're debating, memorizing text after text, and doing the whole thing. I was really living the life of a Tibetan monk. I finished all the preliminary training, the Dura, the Lodik Dadik, finished all of that. And then we're gearing up for 6 years of this detailed study of this text we'd already memorized. And then debating it 5 hours a day for 6 years and studying this text with the commentaries and the sub-commentaries and laying out the whole majestic path. And I was looking at 6 years of that. And just before that next whole phase of training began, I took a meditation course where I had to sit and watch my mind for 11 hours a day for 10 days. And I felt I was in a sewage plant, a junkyard. And if I find any other metaphor you like, I thought, this mind is a disaster area. And why should I study all these elevated stages beyond the initial phase of the Toklam Chungmu, of the small stage of Mahayana Panipyapik? I'm going to study that. I'm going to study a stage beyond that and beyond that and beyond that and Arya Bodhisattvas, stage 2 Arya Bodhisattvas, stage 3. I'm going to be looking at the top of Mount Everest while I'm sitting in a toilet. Not on the toilet, in the toilet. I'm going to look up at this pristine, radiant, clear snow-capped peaks, and it just smells like poop. And I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand it. And as soon as the retreat was over, I just hastened. I had the tremendous good fortune to be able to speak immediately with His Holiness. Because I felt this was like an existential crisis. Because I was at that point, I was the only Westerner in this monastery. And I could debate, so I had a reputation, I could debate. So I wasn't failing, I wasn't flunking out. And I knew my teacher really loved that I was there, and he was really happy I was there, Genlosen Gyatso. And I went and I thought, boy, if I bail out, I'm going to disappoint so many people. Because I had to, people would come and watch the Westerner debate. it's like the old story, it's not that the bear dances well, it's the fact that the bear can dance at all. And they'd watch this Westerner debating all the Tibetans. And wow, the bear can dance. So I went and made a beeline for His Holiness, and I just laid my heart on the table. And I said, I just don't want to be doing this scholarly study for 6 years of all these elevated states when my mind is just so afflicted. Let's just put it mildly. What I'd like to do is lay a foundation. I'd like to study Satipatthana. I'd like to study the 4 applications of mindfulness, which are right there at stage 1. I'd like to lay a foundation to realize these paths and not just study them intellectually and debate about them and beat other people in debate. I'd like to actually taste it. And this is very, very personal. I mean, it's rather emotional for me, but I felt if he said, that's really stupid. If he told me that, well, that's a bad idea. You're doing well in this training. What do you want to throw it away for? This is really, you're a numbskull. If he told me something like that, I would have been crushed. I would have been devastated. Because I just, it knew in my heart, I couldn't do it. And so I went in, somebody said, I came in and said, I'm approaching you with some timidness or a little bit of fear here about something about which there was no grounds for fear. And I approached the Dalai Lama with fear. I thought, if he tells me this is a really terrible idea, I would have been crushed. And he said, very good. Very good. And he only encouraged me. He said, we do get caught up in the commentaries and the sub-commentaries. We do get caught up in a lot of intellectualization. And you want to go back to the practice? Very good. And he said, one of his kind of doctrinal consultants, superb Geshe and scholar, Kusho Lati Rinpoche, he said, Kusho Lati Rinpoche, he'll help you. He'll help you. So I discontinued my monastic training. Just went up in the mountains and studied Satipatthana for about a year and a half. Studied, practiced, trained as much as I could. So that was maybe much more detail than you needed. Maybe I've wasted your time. But that's where it comes from. That's where it comes from. The shamatha is there. And on the basis of shamatha, there are two... There's one path, if one really wanted to just lay, just for the time being, a really absolutely solid, rock-solid foundation in the Shravakayana, then three things, just nail it. And they are so full, so rich, that I think if that's the path you want to follow to your own liberation, shamatha, the four immeasurables, and the four applications of mindfulness. Boy, that is just, that's full. It's balanced, it's deep, it's noble, and that could be the practice. And so if you're looking for your own liberation, that's it. That's your lumrim. Carry on until you're enlightened, until you're an arhat, right? So there's that. So that's a possibility. Shamatha, and then just simply continue with the four immeasurables and continue on. Then develop the vipassana by way of the four applications of mindfulness. And there's just nothing beyond that. That's the highest. There's nothing higher than that in all of Theravada tradition, in the Shravaka as a whole. If one is really dedicated to the Mahayana path, the Bodhisattva ideal, wishes to become a Buddha, then upon the basis of having a truly serviceable mind, sem lesurunga in Tibetan, then two paths lay themselves out. And I think in terms of if we eventually have 8-week retreats here, I think it would make more sense to do 8 weeks on one and then 8 weeks on another. 8 weeks on one would be really focusing on bodhicitta, the bodhisattva way of life, and lojong. And those are all classic teachings, but more on the method, skillful means side. And then another 8-week retreat, really focusing on the Satipatthana. But there's both the Shravakayana approach and there's Mahayana approach to the four applications of mindfulness. And they fit, they blend perfectly. And so then you have the method and wisdom, right? And you're laying now a foundation for the whole Mahayana path, for the five paths, the 10 bhumis. You're now laying the foundation with a serviceable mind, developing the whole Bodhisattva way of life, and developing the four Satipatthanas with the full richness of the fundamental teachings in the Pali Canon, but with also the tremendous insights from the Mahayana tradition, specifically applying Majjhimika insights of emptiness into the four applications of mindfulness. And so I was reflecting upon this, because I think since you gave me the question, I had time to reflect upon it. It strikes me that just taking those two together, like the two wings of the bird, that would be the way to go. Learn one, learn the other, but then put them together. And I can imagine a 3-year retreat, 5-year retreat, however long it takes, of just going back and forth between method and wisdom, like flapping one wing, flapping another, although that's not quite how birds really do it. That's an epileptic bird. But in one retreat, if you can imagine it, inspire yourself. I hope it inspires the heck out of me. But imagine in a retreat meditating like 10 hours a day, and half of it's really for the cultivation of bodhicitta, the four immeasurables, deepening those, developing the bodhisattva way of life, the lojong, and half is all about wisdom. And then just going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, until the bodhicitta arises and it's sealed with the insights of the four satipatthana. Then you've achieved the karasa, tepichimbu soklam ding. You've now achieved... And I'm checking with my scholar friend, because Mugi has studied this extensively in one of the great monastic universities in South India. He's from my lineage then. So Sera, one of the three great monastic universities. So then you achieve the medium stage of the Mahayana path of accumulation, and now your bodhicitta is sealed. It's kind of like they got a lock on it. It's in the safe. Nobody will steal it, because it's sealed with wisdom. And that bodhicitta, the first one is called the earth-like bodhicitta, because it's the foundation for the rest of the path. But the second level of bodhicitta is gold-like, sertabu, semke. The gold-like bodhicitta, that is, it will never become non-gold. You'll have bodhicitta from now on. So the question was, so there's the foundation. And I just want to emphasize, this is just absolutely, has nothing to do with Alan Wallace. That's so important. This is core Dharma, really core Dharma. It's ancient, but what's weird, since I told you that this text is studied by all four traditions, show me the monastery. Show me the monastery where the focus is all on developing Mahayana path accumulation. I don't know what's happened. Did we lose our way? What? I don't know what happened. But I think this is incredibly inspiring. And so we have the shamatha, we have the bodhicitta, we have the vipassana, the four applications of mindfulness, and then there's a realization of bodhicitta. Then the question, and then I've made reference to realizing pristine awareness, or rikpa, using Dzogchen. But the question is, how do devotional practices and Vajrayana fit into this process? Well, devotional practices go all the way along, and as I mentioned to Stacey when we met privately, there are devotional practices that take place within the context of really historical Buddhism, that is consensual, the Pali canon, the Buddha as a human individual, and the devotion to this individual who lived long ago, devotion to the Sangha who kept the torch lit ever since then, the devotion to the Dhamma. And so there's that level of, so, I mean, the Thai people, the Sri Lankan people are very devotional, and it's out of that context. There's a whole level of devotional practice that comes out of Mahayana. And that's flourished in all Mahayana countries, a level of devotional practice that comes out of Vajrayana, another basis, another context for devotional practice. But to answer the question, where does Vajrayana practice come in? Well, let's focus just for the time being and simply on stage of generation and completion. Because really in all schools of Tibetan Buddhism, they're honing right in on that, highest yoga tantra, stage of generation, completion, and everything else is kind of preparation for those two phases. And so, where does this fit in? Well, once again, this is utterly classic Indian and Tibetan Buddhism. You lay your Sutrayana foundation with sublime ethics. You take your Bodhisattva precepts and you keep them. You keep at least the lay precepts, or if you take monastic, you keep those precepts. So you have your ethical foundation, rock solid, gold solid. And then you develop your shamatha. This is just classic. It's Shila Samadhi Prajna. Upon the basis of ethics, then you develop samadhi. And that's not only samadhi, but it's developing the four measurables, it's developing bodhicitta, and on the basis of that, then you develop wisdom. That's the classic core lumrim of all of Buddhism. And it's the core also of all of the lumrims of Tibet, for all schools. It's the lamde in the Tibetan tradition, it's the words of my perfect teacher in the Nyingma tradition, it's the jewel ornament of liberation in the Kagyu tradition, it's lamrim chemo in the Gelupa tradition. They're really all singing the same song, with only subtle variations. And what they're all saying is, develop your renunciation, develop your bodhicitta, develop your shamatha, develop vipassana, and now that you've laid this foundation, and you've realized shamatha, and you've realized bodhicitta, and you've realized vipassana, now state regeneration. That's the classic sequence. I didn't make up anything there. Absolutely classic. So now, if you wish to follow the path of state regeneration, then from that point, then you find a Vajrayana, a Vajracharya, Vajrayana master, you receive empowerment, transmission, commentary, you receive guidance in the state of regeneration. And if you've got those three, if you have that foundation, if you have shamatha, if you've developed bodhicitta already and you've developed some genuine insight into emptiness, you may finish the state of regeneration in a relatively short time. Practice full time, then don't mess around. Just go into retreat, practice full time. You may actually fully achieve the state of regeneration in a couple of years. Not at all unreasonable. If you've not achieved shamatha, you can spend 20 lifetimes. That's just literally true. You know? And so, and if you've achieved stage of generation, really fully achieved it, then enlightenment in one lifetime of a Buddha, that's really possible. Really possible. So you do stage of generation, stage of completion. If you're following the path of Dzogchen, you may very well do some or a great deal of stage regeneration and stage of completion practice. There are ways of contracting it, ways of expanding it, and that's just individual, a matter of the student and the lama. But there is, if one wanted to take the most essential, if you're following the Dzogchen path, if you ask, and a number of you know the answer to this already, but if you're following the Dzogchen path, absolutely committed to it, and you're well prepared, and you ask, what is utterly essential? As for samadhi, what is utterly essential is access to the first jhana. That's essential. If you want to achieve more, great, fine. But this is essential, right? Because it's not just, oh, now I can meditate for 4 hours at a stretch. Something really important has happened to your whole prana system. The whole your energy system has shifted when you achieve shamatha. It's a big deal. Lung korang lesung rung cha. Your prana system now becomes serviceable. Your body becomes supple, buoyant. It has this prashrapta, shinjang, physical buoyancy, mental buoyancy. You have extremely tuned your mind, and it's a discontinuity there. It's not just a little bit yet better than yesterday. You now have a body and mind on the energetic level and the mental level that are raring to go. So it's a big deal. If you achieve first actual state of the first jhana, oh good, that's just a bit more. But actually achieving samadhi, it's a very big deal. So what's absolutely essential if you're following the Dzogchen path, utterly committed to this, you have a qualified teacher, is first of all do the preliminaries so that you've created the ground, you've cultivated, so that when you get to shamatha, you don't just wind up meeting a wall of boulders, a wall of obstacles, but you try to dispel them somewhat first. And then you achieve shamatha. Where does this come from? Is this Alan Wallace's tradition? I don't have a tradition. This is Lerap Lingba. This is Dujum Lingba. It's many of the other great Dzogchen masters, but I'm relying especially on Dujum Lingba. And he was a consummate teacher, master. It said that 13 of his disciples achieved rainbow body. 13 of his disciples achieved Buddhahood. And he lived way up in nomadic Tibet. I mean, it's amazing. He must have been I don't know if there's any teacher in the 19th century that paralleled that. Jalu Tomgen, Juk Sumre, Halele Chre. Halele, amazing. So in his Vajra Essence, or in Tibetan it's called Nelu Ranjung, in the Vajra Essence, he lays out the whole path. And he tells at the end of the text. This was actually a mind transmission that he had, so it's a Gnostic text. At the end of the text, he said, everything you need to know to achieve enlightenment in one lifetime, it's here. You don't need to look outside of this book. He doesn't say, don't do it. He just said, everything's here. He makes about a one-line reference to the preliminaries and says, do them. And then he goes right to shamatha, spends about 20 pages unpacking shamatha, specifically settling the mind in its natural state, and he says it's indispensable. Everybody does, but he said it very clearly. And then to the vipassana. Indispensable, of course. And then there's a fork in the road. Once you have the shamatha, vipassana, not simply the four satipatthana, but insight into emptiness. Then there's a fork in the road. And what he states, and I'm not adding anything here, because if I did it, it would just be like throwing garbage in to a pool of nectar. I don't want to do that. That at this point, there's a fork in the road. He said, for those who are drawn to a more elaborate path, and not elaborate just for complexity's sake, but would like a richer path, more diverse path, a fuller path, one with greater elaboration, he said, well, here, and then he speaks for the next 200 pages, lays out in great detail, extraordinary, wonderful clarity, stage of generation, stage of completion. Lays it all out, multiple practices. He said, for those who are drawn to a practice without elaboration, who are looking for an essentialist approach, just want, give me what is utterly indispensable, but life is short, I just want what is core. He said, for those people, he almost says, you can skip to page 297. You can bypass state of generation and completion. And you can go directly to Tekchut, the breakthrough, which is specifically designed to realize Rigpa. Go directly there. Now, I've translated the whole text. How he sets that up is really quite striking. And I see the time, and we will end at 6:05. He brings one back to the four thoughts that turn the mind. Right there, he's deep into the text, way deep into the text. And then he says, now reflect upon the precious human rebirth, reflect upon death and impermanence, reflect upon the nature of suffering, reflect upon the nature of karma. And now we go, phew, and then to right into Rigpa. And then, so that, of course, that's indispensable. And then after realizing Rigpa, then there is the bringing forth what is called the hlundup, the spontaneous displays, the full capacity, fully unveiling the resources of Rigpa itself. This is the compassion of a Buddha, the powers of a Buddha, the wisdom of the Buddha, and so forth, bringing forth fully all the qualities of a Buddha. And for that, there's a second phase of Dzogchen practice, which is called the direct crossing over, or Tutgel. And that's indispensable. And if you bring that to its culmination through four phases, and by the way, the practices are really simple. They're not complex. Of course, I don't mean easy, but they are simple. If you go through those four stages of the direct crossing over, then at the end you're a Buddha. And you'll manifest that in various ways, various manners of rainbow body, the different ways of manifesting rainbow body. But that's finally when you lay your cards on the table. You may be saying until then, oh, I'm a simple Buddhist monk. And then you die and say, oh, not so simple Buddhist monk. His body just dematerialized into pure energy and display of light. And so what follows from this? upon this foundation, which is common to all paths for the Mahayana, the Shamatha, the Bodhicitta, the Vipassana, you may do stage regeneration and completion, and that will take you to Buddhahood. Or you may practice on that basis, the direct crossing over, excuse me, the breakthrough and the direct crossing over, that will take you to Buddhahood. Or you may combine them, as many, many do, and that will take you to Buddhahood. With that basis, the Shamatha, Bodhicitta, Vipassana, speaking of enlightenment in one lifetime, is not fantasy. And I cannot imagine a greater gift to the world than that, to actually become a Buddha. If you want to repay the kindness of sentient beings, look no further. That's the greatest possible way to repay the kindness of others. And so that's that. I think that's that. Is that clear? Okay. So nothing that I said was original. If it was, just throw it out. It's garbage. It's Alan Wallace garbage. But everything there, teachings of Asanga, the teachings of Tsongkhapa, teachings of Dujum Lingpa, teachings of Padmasambhava, this is the great path. It's clear, it's straight, and it's good all the way through. At the beginning, middle, and end. A final comment, and we'll end in 1 minute. Yes, Sebella. Yes, Dzogchen is entirely within the context of Tantra, so you receive empowerment, you receive the Vajrayana precepts, there's a Vajrayana Guru Yoga, it's entirely embedded in, and if one looked, well, but how does this match onto the stage of regeneration and completion? Think of fourth initiation. Direct correspondence. The name initiation, that's time for Dzogchen. Okay? But what this master, and he speaks with utter authority, this is not a debatable point in Dzogchen. He's not an iconoclast or someone, you know, doing his own trip. That the Tekchut and the Turkel, even, and you notice in that sequence, Shamatha Vipassana, Tekchut, Turkel, hey, where's Bodhicitta? Well, you're cultivating Bodhicitta somewhat, but what you're really banking on is when you realize Rigpa, ultimate Bodhicitta, relative Bodhicitta is going to come out. Just flow out like a geyser. And it will flood your mind. So that's it. It's 6:05. I'm going to keep my word. Thank you, Kathleen. So we have more questions on practice tomorrow, but I think that will do it for now. And maybe tomorrow I'll give you a few more tips about lucid dreaming, dream yoga, but not tonight. Okay? Good. Enjoy your evening.